Hey everyone, my name is Tabitha Davis. I'm a civil engineer, a volunteer with the nonprofit Engineers Without Borders, and the host of this podcast. Here's what you can look forward to today on Calculated Change.
I pinky promise this man, proceed to like run out of the room, call my mom and tell her that my life has changed forever.
Jess Thayer shares how her passion, perseverance, and proclivity for problem solving, along with a sacred vow of a pinky promise, put her as a lead in Engineers Without Borders' response to the global pandemic. As an undergraduate at Marquette, Jess traveled to Guatemala for the first time. One of Jess's roles on that trip was to monitor and evaluate completed bridges in the region. The conversations Jess had on this trip have given her a passion that binds her to this work.
I also had to go on these little monitoring trips and talk with the communities and talk to them about how all of our previous projects were doing and how they had affected the communities, and also do some technical assessments. Something I didn't understand at the time. There is something so incredible about going back to a project that you've done and worked on and going and seeing it a couple years later and then talking to the community leaders and realizing, I mean, we're very intentional about making sure that our projects have a good impact and are sustainable, but it is so surreal to get to go back and talk with the same people years later and realize that something you did is like still affecting people. So then after you go on a trip like that, I mean, I don't know how you ever walk away from EWB and walk away from this organization and the work that we do.
After that first trip to Guatemala, Jess continued with her involvement. Through that, she has evaluated, designed, and helped construct 3 pedestrian bridges in Guatemala. She tells me about some of those trips.
And it was this bridge that connected 2 communities across a 40-meter gorge. Half of the community, like one community, would work on like their abutment, and then there would be another group working on the other side of the river. So it was really cool to like get to work with these 2 different communities and then eventually connect them at the end. That was like my introduction to the Guatemalan highlands. And it was so interesting. I remember walking down the first day, and right before traveling, I had just gotten over this mono-like virus, just completely decimated my lung capacity. But then on top of that, we're at altitude, and I'm doing this hike the first day back up the other side. And I'm like, I cannot imagine having to do this every day to get down to the city. No wonder they need a bridge. And then I got down to the bottom, and I was like, how... Also, though, I mean, this isn't like a particularly dangerous crossing. Once you get down there, it was like a creek. And then just understanding what that turns into in the rainy season and why the whole thing was necessary. But you could see where the water comes up to in rainy season. So it was honestly like quite terrifying seeing how powerful that little river can get. While I was on El Bosque, I went and took part of the assessment trip for our next project. And at the time, we only had one lead that we knew of who was taking on this project. And so she needed help with the assessment. So I went with her and led this assessment, met the community for the first time, did all of our surveying. And when I came back to Milwaukee, they convinced me to lead this project with Esther. We go through our full like year of design, you know, get our designs done, review them, submit them, you know, the whole 9 yards. And we go and we build this bridge the next year. And I had told Esther, I was like, I did the cables last year. You have to do them. A cool experience to like be in a harness, you know, tied into the cables and kick these crossbeams out and like be part of like actually decking the bridge. And I was like, you got to do it. And then the morning of, Esther gets very sick.
Jess led this large group in the construction of the bridge. Out of the 21 travelers, only 2 managed to avoid getting sick, Jess included. Despite the obstacles, the team finished the bridge which withstood an earthquake not long after it was built, the ultimate Engineers Without Borders infrastructure test. Jess didn't know at the time, but this was just the beginning of her work fighting illness in Guatemala. Jess has this habit of recognizing a need and filling it. She describes how her role in Engineers Without Borders develops into her role as the Wisconsin State Representative, and she describes the work she does with it.
The year that the Engineers Without Borders National Conference was in Milwaukee, I biked down to the conference, and I go to this session about regional leadership because I had been walking around the conference all weekend and seeing people with these state representative and regional vice president and, you know, all of these regional leadership positions hanging on their name tag. And I was like, what is this? So I go to this session and I find out that we have state representatives in Engineers Without Borders. And behind the scenes of what I had seen as a Marquette chapter participant, I guess, student volunteer, there's these regional steering committees that lead the organization, and they're kind of this middle level connection from headquarters to all of the chapters. And so we're the ones that represent the chapters to leadership. And then I was the state rep for Wisconsin, and I reported or was a part of the Great Lakes Regional Steering Committee. And so we had never had one before in Wisconsin, and Wisconsin's kind of like an EWB powerhouse state. I mean, we have 8 chapters in Wisconsin, 6 student chapters. They're all relatively quite active. They're like really high functioning chapters, and that like we do a ton of projects every year. And so I had to kind of figure out how to create this position.
Jess had a passion for the work of Engineers Without Borders, but up until that point, it had been largely infrastructure and civil focused. Jess has a background as a mechanical engineer with a passion in global health, and she struggled to see how she could fit that into the work of Engineers Without Borders in the future. That was until she made a pinky promise with Michael Paddock. Jess ran into Mike at yet another conference for Engineers Without Borders.
Afterwards, we had this like networking event. We were talking with everyone, and I go and I talk to Mike, and I was like, hey, Mike, we've like worked together in the past. I don't know if you know who I am. Introduce myself again. And I was like, how do I do this but not be a civil engineer? Because I really love med device, and I love being a mechanical engineer in dynamics and robotics and controls. Like, that's my stuff, right? But I want to continue to stay involved in EWB. There has to be a way for me to like use that skill set here. I think at the time I had actually offered, I was like, if there's a way like I can learn how to do structural assessment, like I'll take whatever courses I need to, I'll like get whatever certifications, I'll still do whatever ESC does. And he was like, no, why would you do that? We like actually have this need to connect the skill set that you have with what Engineering Service Corps does. We got talking about how in a lot of, especially in Engineering Service Corps' work, which is the branch of Engineers Without Borders that Mike founded and now kind of leads, especially in that disaster relief or disaster-oriented type work, a lot of times hospitals and healthcare infrastructures are majorly affected in natural disasters. And so at the time we had talked about how eventually I could potentially play a role in getting those hospitals, healthcare infrastructures, health clinics, getting those back up and running, working in partnership with the civil and structural components that were going on. And Mike knew at the time that I was still in school. So he's like, all right, I need you to do 2 things. Number one, I need you to graduate. And then the second thing I need you to do is I need you to pinky promise me that when you're done with school, you're going to find a job that's going to let you do this work and these things that you're very clearly passionate about, and you're going to help me figure out how to start this biomedical engineering, mechanical engineering task force of Engineering Service Corps. I pinky promise this man, proceed to like run out of the room, call my mom and tell her that my life has changed forever. You know, at the time I like knew that this was a huge thing.
Jess intended to start on this work by traveling with Mike the following summer, but instead started an internship with Stryker in Salt Lake City.
I had always known that I wanted to go into the medical device field, but I knew I wanted to do it as a mechanical engineer. So that was my like entry into med device. And I went and worked as a manufacturing engineer and made neurovascular products, so stroke care products all summer.
At this point, Jess is working on fulfilling her pinky promise. She's finishing up her master's program at Marquette and has plans for the summer to start her work with the Engineering Service Corps in Global Health.
But I had planned on spending the summer with Engineering World Health in Guatemala for the summer. I was going to be working in Shayla, basically spending the first month in Spanish school and doing technical training and spending the second month working in hospitals repairing medical equipment. And I was like, this is what I need to do. I need to learn Spanish because I'm useless in Spanish without Spanish dict. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to learn Spanish. I'm going to get this technical training and I'm going to spend the month like understanding these healthcare infrastructures that I want to like work in. And so that seemed like a super good way to do it through their Engineering World Health Summer Institute. Got accepted into the program. Then COVID happens. And I just canceled a big spring break trip. It was supposed to be in Switzerland. Those plans went out the window because COVID was this thing that was happening in Europe. So I go on a national parks road trip. I remember like getting the news. I drive into Big Bend National Park. I lose service. I spend one night there. Then as we're driving out of the park and we come back into service, we have like three emails from Marquette telling us that like classes are disbanded for the next 2 weeks. We're going to go virtual for 2 weeks. COVID is here. It is real. And when I got back, I had to pack up my lab and like move everything home to my bedroom.
Like many people, Jess had to adjust to finishing her master's program from home, but she also had to adjust her summer plans of traveling to Guatemala to volunteer with Engineering World Health.
At the time, I had already accepted a job, and they were like, we need you now. We can't wait for you to start, and we need you to start in June. This seems like something you really care about. You can go next year. And I was like, wait, you're going to let me work for a year and then disappear for 3 months and then come back and still have a job? And they were like, yes. And I was like, okay, I'm going to go work for Medtronic because clearly they are aligned with the things that I want to do. Right. I don't know where you can ever find another company job boss that's going to let you do something like that.
Jess is a surgical robotics control engineer at Medtronic. She tells me the job is even cooler than it sounds, which is impressive because it sounds pretty cool. I love hearing Jess talk about her job because she loves it so much. At this time, Jess was still working on her master's and thesis defense, having had her graduation delayed from COVID. She also moved across the country and started her career in the middle of a global pandemic. Despite all of this, she never lost track of that pinky promise she made to Mike years ago.
And so it's starting to feel very real in Wisconsin, and I'm seeing all of this news about PPE shortages in the U.S. And one of my teachers is like collecting N95s and masks to donate to hospitals all over. There's like some cool research initiatives coming up at Marquette and UW, like looking and trying to address this PPE shortage. And I'm thinking about it in the shower where I have all of my great ideas. And I get out of the shower, walk, you know, the 5 steps across my bedroom to what is now my office. And I see an email from Mike that says, I have an idea. Can you talk?
Years after their promise to integrate global health into the work of Engineers Without Borders, Mike and Jess recognized an urgency to fulfill that commitment at the beginning of the pandemic.
And so we started working with Waleska, who leads the Guatemala country office, And we worked with the Rotary Club, in particular, one of the clubs that we had, that Mike had worked with in the past in the Volcan Fuego response. And we started trying to figure out how we were going to provide enough PPE to the healthcare facilities in basically all of the highland regions of Guatemala. All of the places outside of Guatemala City, which is where the government's focus was going to be, because it's the biggest city, and that made sense. At the time when we were starting it, it didn't feel like it was that difficult of a problem to solve, which I think is so hard to comprehend now, because like I understand the magnitude of the problems that we're facing in all of these different healthcare infrastructures all around the world. But at the time, we were like, well, we need to make face masks and we need to make face shields. And if we have to make face shields out of 2-liter bottles, then we'll make face shields out of 2-liter bottles because we know we have plenty of them in Guatemala. And so I think what's different about the way that we did things was we didn't go into it expecting there to be some golden ticket, elegant solution to this. We were like, we need a solution. We need something that works.
Jess and her team recognized that the alternatives to the PPE they were developing in these already overwhelmed hospitals was no PPE at all. They had to work quickly, developing solutions, even if, as she said, they weren't elegant.
We had to understand as much as we could about the risks, do everything that we could to mitigate it, but also know that not doing anything wasn't an option, and there was never going to be an option that didn't have any risk. And I think that was something that's unique to us because of our background with Engineers Without Borders. And like, understanding when you go to build a bridge in Guatemala, it never goes how you expect it to. You have like the most foolproof plan I know I've like either been a part of or planned construction of 3 different pedestrian bridges. It never goes the way, like there's always something that comes up and you have to improvise. And that is really uncomfortable when you're talking about things in a medical device or healthcare setting. The first thing that we started with was trying to produce face shields locally. And so that was where we pulled Becca in, because she had been involved in the Badger Shield work at UW-Madison. And we started by identifying a bunch of manufacturers that were capable of doing that work. That was where our Rotarian partners were incredibly helpful, because they know, and then they negotiated how we were going to achieve those. And they're like, great, we're going to evaluate these first, you know, 10 of these that you make. So we started by working with the manufacturers. And we also simultaneously found some partner hospitals that were going to kind of be our evaluators of all of these things that we were going to produce. And so we identified these 12 hospitals. Waleska really led the charge, connecting with all of them, talking to them, making sure that doctors, one, knew what we wanted to do, felt that there was a need for it, and then third, would be willing to provide us feedback on whatever prototypes we gave them. So we went back and forth on the face shields a couple of times, figured out a good way to make them, sent 10 to each hospital and got feedback, and then placed a big first order. Then we kind of started working on a little bit of everything. It started with face shields, and then it was face masks, and then it was gowns, and then it was coveralls. And then we started doing research on non-invasive ventilators and regular ventilators. And then we talked with the Ministry of Health, and they were like, we have 60 working ventilators in the country. And so through my connections at Engineering World Health, I reached out to a biomedical engineering technician that would have been teaching me this summer. And we were like, hey, Joe, we have a bunch of broken ventilators at all of these regional hospitals. Can we send you to go assess them and figure out if we can fix them? Because new ventilators cost a lot of money and we don't have enough working ones. So let's try to fix the broken ones because we have a lot of those and maybe that'll be cheaper. And so we sent Joe to go do ventilator assessment, and then we sent him back again to do ventilator repairs after coordinating this crazy mess of getting parts and manuals and repair manuals, maintenance manuals. And that was the ventilator piece. And then we got connected with a ventilation expert. And she was like, you guys really, she's an expert in the pulmonary biomechanics of ARDS and the pulmonary biomechanics of how to ventilate lungs affected by ARDS. Look at solutions before people get to ventilators. So then we started looking at non-invasive ventilators. We found bubble helmets. We figured out how to get them to Guatemala. The work that our team did there was, it was never our own design. It was taking a bunch of solutions from all over the place, whether that be the new masks at the Prakash lab at Stanford or these bubble helmets that were being produced somewhere in the US, somewhere in Texas, or repairing ventilators that were made somewhere else. We just basically took all of these things and all of this work that was being put out there and shared open source, sometimes for the first time because of the pandemic, and figured out how to make it work in Guatemala quickly. So it was a lot of just like evaluating other people's work, figuring out if it was something we could reasonably do, and then fighting like mad for money to do it. There was really nothing very glamorous about what we did. Just being really resourceful and stubborn and understanding the context that we were working in. I think what this has taught us is that when COVID is over, when we get through this, and we will get through it, we have to invest in local production of medical devices everywhere because it creates jobs, it creates job security, and it also makes sure that resources are available to the places nearest there.
Jess hopes to integrate these lessons learned into the continued work of the Engineering Service Corps and Engineers Without Borders as they work to create resilient infrastructure across the globe.
The important part, and I think this is where Engineers Without Borders and Engineering Service Corps can help to play a role and can help to build the resiliency of healthcare infrastructures in low and middle income countries, is that we have to take all of these great solutions, great engineering, and great science and figure out how to make it work everywhere. Because if we've learned anything from a virus like COVID, is it's not gone until it's gone everywhere. Because we are so connected.
Fighting a pandemic is hard, exhausting, and sometimes seemingly impossible work. But the time and efforts Jess and her team put in paid off.
I think about it and it's like, it would have been so easy to just say, this is too big. So many people in so many places did. And it would have been so easy to say, this is too big. But also, I can't imagine not doing it, right? Like, when we look at the hospitals that we didn't work with in Guatemala, and God, I wish we could have worked with all of them, but like we only had so many dollars, you know, so many dollars and so many man hours. And when I look at how COVID affected those facilities versus the facilities that we worked in, where we didn't have any doctors or any healthcare providers get sick. I mean, like, how can you not like want to get involved in something like this and be ready to take on that challenge, even if you're like so tired? It's easy to be a pessimist, but I'm really thankful that there's a lot of optimists out there that showed up in really big ways during this pandemic.
Jess wrote a letter to Mike, who had been such an inspiration to her at the beginning of this work. She started it with the line, "The only people that can change the world are the ones who believe they can." Through her story, I hope you see in Jess someone who has had the courage to believe in positive change, and I hope that gives you permission to do the same.
Becca and I were like, I can't believe we're working with Mike Paddock. And then it was, oh my God, I can't believe we just got an email from someone at the UN. And then it was, I can't believe I just spoke at a UN meeting and was on a panel. And now it's like, I get off the phone on a Tuesday morning on a phone call from Mozambique. And I'm like, okay, time to go to work. It's just the normal day. And I think there's like so much power in hearing these stories, because we had the same disbelief. Becca and I have figured out some, hopefully just a sliver of what we're capable of during this time. And I hope that we can continue to do more and more as we move forward. But I also hope that people can realize, like, there's nothing that makes me special here. You know, I'm just a pretty stubborn, optimistic person that felt like, well, hey, I should at least try.
Thanks for listening to Calculated Change. We hope this episode inspired you to not only see that positive change is possible, but to know that you have a role in that positive change. If you like this episode, feel free to follow us on our socials at Calculated Change, email us at calculatedchange@gmail.com, or subscribe for more episodes. Thanks, everyone. See you next time.